All right, we'd like to sing again in your little songbooks on page number 3 at the bottom. Plenty of bread at the feast of life. We'll assume you remember how that goes, those of you who've come in since we taught it. Follow along, it's simple. You respond at the bottom from the leader parts with, you have plenty. I got a key on there. You have plenty to share. Let's try that.
You have plenty to share.
And then you have plenty to share.
You have plenty to share.
You have plenty to share. You have plenty of bread to share.
You have plenty to share. You have plenty of bread to share.
Well, while you're at it, channel him and ask him if he's really John Mark or just who is he? So a song like this makes me think some kind of channeling was going on between Tom and Mary and Marty Haugen and somebody, because this capsule encapsulates perfectly what we're going to try to do this morning with Mark's second feeding story in the aftermath. But first, I want to say that I've had numerous conversations with people in the village in the last 24 hours about the humanity of Jesus. I think there are plenty of Christians and quasi-Christians in the world who are perfectly comfortable with the humanity of Jesus and are somewhat startled that there are actually people that see divinity or deity in Jesus. And we're kind of the opposite sort of crowd, I guess. We seem to be folks who have been, due to our upbringing, a bit more comfortable with the divine and godly Jesus than the Jesus who yells and screams and does some of the things that we witnessed yesterday. So it's a bit unsettling sometimes to see Jesus in the positions that we saw him yesterday. I don't know if any of the rest of you have questions. questions about that that you'd like to raise in this group for just a moment this morning, we could do a moment of old business. otherwise, we can move on. The second feeding story of a multitude is where we start this morning, Mark chapter 8. And I think probably it makes sense to simply go ahead and get that read out into the space. Mark 8 verses 1 to 9 is where we begin. And if someone would read that aloud, please, that would be wonderful.
In those days, when there was again a great crowd without anything to eat, he called his disciples and said to them, "I have compassion for the crowd because they have been with me now for 3 days and have nothing to eat. If I send them away hungry to their homes, they will faint on the way, and some of them will have come from a great distance." His disciples replied, "How can one feed these people with bread here in the desert?" He asked them, "How many loaves do you have?" And they said, 7. And then he ordered the crowd to sit down on the ground, and he took the 7 loaves, and after giving thanks, he broke them and gave them to his disciples to distribute, and they distributed them to the crowd. They had also a few small fish, and after blessing them, he ordered that these too should be distributed. They ate and were filled, and they took up the broken pieces left over, 7 baskets full. Now there were about 4,000 people, and he sent them away.
All right, thank you, wonderful. Well, there are a lot of ways we could start the conversation about this second feeding of a multitude. One would be to set them next to each other, the feeding of the 5,000 in Mark and the feeding of the 4,000 in Mark, and look at the similarities and differences. And we will be doing some of that. Another thing that you find immediately, if you start to study this text with the help of commentaries and whatnot, is that almost everybody points out that we have two very similar sequences in Mark 6 and 7 and then in Mark 8. In Mark 6, we had a feeding of the 5,000, followed by a story of crossing the sea and a remarkable incident that happens out there, followed by a controversy with the Pharisees, in this case over clean and unclean, followed by the story of the Syrophoenician woman, an unclean woman who becomes a kind of a test for this clean and unclean thing, among other things, followed by the healing of a man deaf and dumb. Then when we get to chapter 8, we start the same cycle over again almost with a feeding of a multitude, a crossing of the sea, a controversy with Pharisees, not so much a test of, I mean, this is actually a test story, the leaven of the Pharisees and the Herodians who test Jesus, and then the healing of a blind man. So some commentaries can only say, well, Mark had two cycles of stories like this and he had to use them both. Or they were doublets, and it's really kind of all the same stuff, and he just used both sequences. What I suggested yesterday gives you at least the beginnings of what I think is going on here, that this woman who settled for crumbs and would not take no for an answer and led Jesus to give what was meant for the children to the Gentiles changed the whole economy of his work, and he now goes up, and the first thing to notice about this next meal is that it's happening in Gentile territory. This meal happens over in the region of the Decapolis, in strictly Gentile territory, which leads me to say that what happened there with the Syrophoenician woman means that now we don't just feed the children in the family, now we're feeding everyone. We will feed the nations, we will feed the Gentiles. And then we'll have this other sequence of stories that we see. But let's look at what's similar and what's different to see What else we can learn besides the fact that Jesus will now feed the Gentiles? Maybe we should play pretend we're in class here this morning. Let me ask you, what do you see that's similar? In what ways is this an identical meal to the feeding of the 5,000?
Menu's the same.
I'm sorry.
The menu is the same.
All right, the menu is, it's the same stuff. The amounts are different. We'll get to that. So it's bread and fish.
Compassion is in both stories.
Okay, the compassion is mentioned in both stories?
Well, no, is compassion in the 5,000? It's not quite
yes,
as...
Yes, it is.
It's not quite
he
as...
had compassion on them because they were like sheep.
Oh, in that part, okay.
So the splunknidzomai thing, the gut wrenching.
Oh yeah.
Happens in both, and but if we go beyond that, we're into differences. So, and the differences are significant. What else is the same?
Leftovers.
There's leftovers.
I noticed in both stories he first ordered them to sit down. I wonder what the significance of that was. Like, they had to sit down before they received.
Yeah, I didn't study that. I presume that it's a hospitality. They will sit, he will serve. Or he and the disciples will serve.
Jumped out at me this time, that they went 3 days without food. Did they do that in the first feeding too, 3 days without food? I don't know.
I don't think the time reference is the same. That,
the attitude of the disciples is the same. They're in both stories that disciples don't have a solution in mind or don't see a solution in sight.
Okay. Yeah, both times the disciples can't figure out how they're going to handle this.
There's a blessing each time.
Okay, there's a oikaristo. Jesus gives thanks, blesses, and, he doesn't bless the bread. This time he just gives thanks and gave it to them and distributed it. Okay? Similar, we're not in the same place, but we are in Eremos. We are in the wilderness. It's not quite as, we're not reminded quite as often. In the first story, Mark keeps saying, this is a lonely place. This is in Eremos, and so on and so on. Just have one reference there in verse 4. How can one feed these people here in the wilderness, the desert? Anything else that's the same? Well, all right, what's different?
In the second story, isn't this a group that's been traveling with him for 3 days? And at least it was more of a gathering that happened around him?
All right, there does seem to be a longer time of hunger involved. 3 days of starving. 3 days of fasting.
In the first story, he commands the disciples to give them something to eat, and in the second story, he takes the lead on that.
Okay, and that's a clue also to where exactly they got the bread. The disciples didn't have any bread in the first story, and they had to find some. They thought they might have to go to town to buy it. And Jesus says, you give them something to eat, and they don't have anything. This time, where actually does the bread come from?
The disciples.
Yeah.
Is there any significance to the fact that the disciples didn't know what to do the second time? I mean, they just had done this. They just had fed a large group. Why didn't they know? Why were they still clueless?
Yeah, And if you think that's bad, wait till we get a couple paragraphs further. When they forget their lunch. We're building on a theme here of cluelessness.
It's green grass in the first story, and it was South Dakota Badlands.
All right, we are really off. We don't even have any green grass this time. We're just sitting in the desert, that's true.
Numbers.
All right, the numbers are different. Feeding of the 5,000, feeding of the 4,000. The numbers of loaves.
Seven
as opposed to?
Five.
And the numbers of?
Leftovers. Seven.
Seven baskets. As opposed to 12 baskets.
No, but these were large baskets.
Yeah, there's a very interesting difference between the kinds of baskets that may or may not be significant. This is the kind of stuff I told you my students think I'm ingesting strange subjects before coming to class. In the first story, I don't necessarily know the Greek, but I mean it's kofinon, which are traditional Jewish baskets used for carrying things, and it's specifically in the second story, Sthrigas, which are baskets for carrying fish. So a fisherman's baskets.
Are they bigger?
I honestly don't know. I've never used them. So I've never seen a picture of these. I only know that they're fisherman's equipment as opposed to bread baskets.
Is there any significance, do you think, in the first story, the fish and the bread appear at the same time in the breast? And in this one, it appears the bread first, and then they come along with the fish.
It could be, because, I mean, I'm gonna suggest that there's something here about these baskets, and that the fish play a different role. Well, there's no point in being sneaky about this. You know, fishing and fishing baskets and so forth play an important role in two other Gospels, not so much in Mark. But as I said, people pick stuff up from Mark and use it. There's a little fishing going on here. You know, we're collecting things. We're not just collecting bread, we're collecting people. We're building a people here, and the other great image for building a people in at least two of the Gospels is the great net, hauling the dragnet through the world and collecting all different kinds in your net. And here are these fishermen gathering stuff up in fishing baskets among the Gentiles. Maybe a hint. Jesus has compassion on these people, but he has compassion on them for a different reason in this story. The first time it was because they were like sheep without a shepherd, and we indicated that shepherd talk is always political talk among the Jewish people. They have no king, which isn't exactly true. They've got a king. His name is Herod. So that, you know, there's a political statement involved here. They don't really have a king. They don't have a king of the kind that this people ought to have. And he has compassion on them, and like a faithful king, he feeds them. In that first story, this time he we don't have the allusions to politics. We simply have the illusion, I mean, we have the motive of feeding starving people. In truth, he's not going to be ultimately named in this gospel the King of the Gentiles. He's going to be named the King of the Jews. There's some slight difference between the relationship here. These are starving people. They don't just need a king. It's almost like they've never had a king. They have not had food. They haven't been fed the way these other people have. And they have come a long distance. These are the people from far and wide, the starving masses. This is not the same as the Jewish people pining away without a true shepherd. An easy enough way for us to picture a Gentile audience from a theological point of view. We have 7 loaves. Most commentaries are quick to point out that the 5 loaves, 5 always reminds you of Torah and the 5 books. The commentaries guess that the 7 loaves are enough for the 70 cities of the Gentiles. It's enough to feed all the Gentiles. At least according to Jewish tradition, there were 70 cities of the Gentiles. This is kind of guesswork at this point, obviously. And Jesus doesn't tell the disciples to feed the people. They don't discuss going to town to buy food. Jesus rather asks, "What do you have?" And they come up from their own resources with 7 loaves and a few fish, which means, with that other story in mind, not necessarily the last feeding story, but that's related, but the story of the Syrophoenician woman, we're now using the children's bread. We're using the disciples' bread, the family's bread, to feed these other people. So we're doing precisely this time what in the story of the Syrophoenician woman we thought we could never do. There's the same thanking and distributing, but this time at the end, Jesus sends them away. The verb is apoleo, which is a verb that means, among other things, to forgive, to pronounce, to absolve, to pronounce absolution on someone. It means to free, to liberate, to let go. But it also means to release someone, to send them away. Not in the sense of apostello, like the apostle word, to send them on a mission. Not in the sense of ekbalo, like he did with that leper who he threw out, but in the sense of releasing, freeing them to go their way, as though they had been in some kind of bondage that they didn't even know, perhaps. So there's all sorts of possible words of good news in that one little verb for how they are sent away. And as I said, we have then those different baskets, which may mean that this is the beginning of a meal of collecting disciples from among the Gentiles. So there's all kinds of little things. By the way, someone asked me yesterday whether the crumbs in the story of the Syrophoenician woman were the same as the crumbs and fragments left over at the end of the 2 banquet stories, and the fact is they're not. So it's not like we can say, well, with the crumbs from the first meal, you know, we can't get a corresponding linguistic link there. But it is interesting that the word in both of the feeding of the multitude stories for the fragments is a word for what's klasma, which means chunks, fragments. But the word in the story of the Syrophoenician woman, psikion, means little tiny crumbs. The little stuff that you need a little broom to sweep up. No one picked them up. So this woman wasn't just settling for chunks and fragments, but for the stuff that the dogs would lick off the floor. That's what she was willing to settle for. Okay? So we've got a feeding of the Gentiles, which I believe is in a way a direct reaction and response on the part of Jesus to the Syrophoenician woman. Let's move on. Verses 10 to 13. Would somebody read those aloud? And immediately Jesus got into the boat with his disciples and went to the district of Dalmanutha. The Pharisees came and began to argue with him, asking him for a sign from heaven to test him. And he sighed deeply in his spirit and said, "Why does this generation ask for a sign? Truly I tell you, no sign will be given to this generation." And he left them. And getting into the boat again, he went across to the other side. So it's a moment of frustration. And it is one of the moments where Jesus privately, but he has an attitude of a sort that isn't exactly, well, he doesn't say, "Oh, those silly people, they'll soon learn." The verb in verse 12 for sighing deeply is a verb that means to have a rather angry and frustrated response, or an extreme response of the kind that you have in the throes of death. The same verb is used in a piece of literature I'm sure that Mark knew well, and there's various reasons for saying that, what we call 2 Maccabees. 2 Maccabees 6:30, there is the story of the death of Eleazar, the man who was tortured to death because he refused to take a bite of pork into his mouth in the days of the Hellenistic Empire. And when he was just about to die under the blows of his tormentors, we read that he groaned aloud and he said, "It's clear to the Lord in his holy knowledge that though I might have been saved from death, I'm enduring terrible sufferings in my body under this beating, but in my soul I'm glad to suffer these things because of my faithfulness to him." And that verb for groaning aloud under the torture of tormentors is the same verb as the verb for what Jesus does here when these people come and ask him for a sign, testing him. The Pharisees, as we see, pop up all over the place in Mark, like spies hiding in the bushes to test and accuse Jesus. We don't know where Dalmanutha is. It's a place that's lost to us. But what is it that these people want? What is the sign? A sign, perhaps, that it's okay to feed Gentiles? We're now going to give the bread of the angels, desert food, to Gentiles? Whatever it is that they're doing is described with the verb that we find in Mark 1 for the trial or the test to which Jesus is put in that wilderness. So what goes on here immediately after the feeding of the 4,000 is a temptation scene. The temptation word, perazo, in Greek, is used. here, the Pharisees put him to the test about bread, about feeding people in the wilderness, which you'll remember is precisely the content of, or part of the content of the feeding in the wilderness in the way that Mark and Luke tell the story. Mark and Luke add this business about, why don't you turn some of these rocks into bread? If you do that, you could feed everyone. Man, that's what people want. That's the kind of Messiah people want. Just do it. If you could turn stones into bread, you could turn... You know, nobody would ever need food. There's a lot of rocks. And if you could turn stones into bread, you could turn them into medicine, iPods, Blackberries, and everything else that people want. Nobody'd ever want for anything. So we've got another bread temptation of some kind going on out here in the wilderness. What kind of Messiah will Jesus be is the content of the testing in the wilderness in Matthew and Luke. And here we get a taste of that same kind of debate. What kind of Messiah will this be? Only the issue seems to be a Messiah also for the Gentiles, not merely for the Jews. The people ask for a sign. Jesus doesn't give them one. He simply leaves. Perhaps this is in the sequence that's building. Perhaps the point is that the only sign these people are going to get finally is the crucifixion, not the sign that they want. Okay, on to the next paragraph. Anybody want to read verses 14 through 21?
But the disciples discovered they had forgotten to bring any food, so there was only one loaf of bread with them in the boat. As they were crossing the lake, Jesus warned them, "Be aware of the yeast of the Pharisees and of Herod." They decided he was saying this because they hadn't brought any bread. Jesus knew what they were thinking, so he said, "Why are you so worried about having no food? Won't you ever learn to or understand? Are your hearts so hard to take it in? You have eyes. Can't you see? You have ears. Can't you hear? Don't you remember anything at all? What about the 5,000 men I fed with 5 loaves of bread? How many baskets of leftover did you pick up afterward?" 12, they said. "And when I fed the 4,000 with 7 loaves, how many large baskets of leftovers did you pick up?" 7, they said. "Don't you understand even yet?" he asked them.
All right. We're chuckling because this is the disciples just not getting anything, you know, and we have to laugh at people who have just witnessed 2 great feedings of multitudes, and they panic because they have only 1 loaf for lunch among them. And you can just about see Jesus smacking his face. You buy him books, and you buy him books, and they won't read them. Or something. The commentaries on Mark all agree that this is a difficult passage with numerous problems, textual and otherwise. You know, some of it is just a mystery of the symbolism. I mean, what in the world is this yeast thing about with the Pharisees and with Herod? For one thing, it's worth noting that the Pharisees and Herod are kind of the axis of evil in Mark's gospel. They keep showing up. This pair of people are kind of a symbol of a certain kind of opposition or alternative to Jesus. In chapter 3, verse 6, after Jesus heals a man with a withered hand on the Sabbath day, we read that the Pharisees went out and immediately conspired with the Herodians against him how to destroy him. So the Pharisees and the Herodians would never, ever be on the same page about anything. The Herodians were the party of Hellenized collaborators with Rome. And to think that Pharisees, the obsessively orthodox folks of the day, would have anything to do with Hellenized collaborators is just ludicrous. But they could agree that there was something about Jesus that was worth the two of them banding together. In chapter 12, verses 13 and following, the same configuration, the Pharisees and the Herodians test Jesus with questions about whether or not to pay their taxes. With that thing that ends up with the well whose picture is on the coin and all that. The idea is to destroy Jesus. And Mark says through this conversation that these two represent a different kind of yeast at work in the culture, in the people, among the folks of that day. What does it mean to call them yeast? Beware the yeast of the scribes and of the Pharisees and Herodians. Well, commentaries point out that yeast was a sign elsewhere in the Bible of corruption, of pollution, of bad stuff at work making things ferment and turn rotten. And so maybe the Pharisees and Herodians are this wicked influence that's wrecking everything. However, you know, everyone knew you couldn't make regular bread without yeast. There's Passover bread, of course, which is unleavened bread, but these bacteria are your friend, actually. And so another way to understand this is that the Pharisees and the Herodians are also bread makers. They have a way to feed the people too. And so this is really a conversation about alternative ways to feed people. The Pharisees' way to feed the people is through observance of Torah and the perfect Sabbath. The Herodians' way of feeding the people and getting folks what they needed was through collaboration with Rome and the crafty use of power. Jesus' way is a different way. And they're putting him to a certain kind of test, conspiring against him. And the real argument is about what will it take for this people to have what really gives them life. The Pharisees have a way. The Herodians have a way. Jesus has a way. So that's another level of this on top of, at least I think, on top of the simple question about, you know, don't the disciples get it? And in this context about who's got bread, the disciples comment about the yeast argument. When Jesus says, beware of the yeast of the Pharisees and Herodians, and they think, well, he's saying this because we don't have bread. On one level, we don't know what he's talking about. This is not making sense to us. But in this other level of the story, we don't seem to have a plan. We don't have anything that we recognize that we can give them because they don't understand what they've just been given. It's not just that they don't understand that they don't have lunch. It's they don't understand they've just had two times the Messianic banquet. They simply don't grasp the food that they've been given to feed the people, and they think they don't have an alternative to what the Pharisees and the Herodians want to give the people. They don't yet understand the gift. It's not just about their lunch. It's about them not getting the Messianic kingdom. Okay, so that's the second level of the story. Now I think there's a third level that we can talk about, and this one is going to take some background. Some of you, well, everybody knows that the ending of Mark, as we talked about the other day, seems defective. We don't know where Jesus went. All you have is Mark's gospel. You seem to have no appearance stories of the risen Jesus, and so you just live with this odd suggestion from the young man at the tomb that you'll see him out there if you go to Galilee, you will eventually see him. Well, how do you do that? All the other Gospels have these appearance stories, and one of the functions of these stories is to teach the church, where is this Jesus whom you say is risen from the dead, and what is he doing? And that was a question that both insiders and outsiders were asking. Okay, folks, you say this Jesus of yours is risen, where is he? What's he doing? If you just show us this risen Jesus, if there's a guy risen from the dead, he must be somewhere, right? Just introduce us to this risen guy, and we'll gladly believe you. Can you imagine that challenge being offered to the church? Well, all the Gospels had their ways of answering this question. Luke's is the most elaborate. In a certain way, you have this wonderful Emmaus story in which the lesson is that you can be right there with the risen Christ and not recognize it. In fact, that's the case all over the place. Every story in the New Testament that has a story of the risen Jesus, with one exception, they wonder, who is this really? You can look right at him. Mary Magdalene thinks it's the gardener at the beginning of John 20. And, the Emmaus disciples only see this stranger because their eyes were kept from recognizing him and so forth. So the point is, he can be right with you and you don't recognize him until you participate in the breaking of the bread. And then you recognize that if you study the scriptures with his way of doing it, that is looking for the necessity that the Christ must suffer, then you start catching on. I'm going through the Emmaus story now, and Luke, you can probably tell. And then they realize they wouldn't have had this experience in the first place if they hadn't invited this stranger into their home and showed him hospitality and discovered what people in Matthew's parable discover, that when you do something for the little and the strangers in the world, you find yourself in the presence of the risen Christ. Well, what about Mark? What are we supposed to think in Mark? Well, in Mark, there is one obvious story that we're supposed to look at this point. There is a story in Mark in which specific directions are given. Don't tell this one now. Tell this one after the Son of Man is raised from the dead. Then go back and tell this story. Remember what story that is?
The Christ.
The Transfiguration. As they're coming down the mountain, Jesus says, don't tell anyone this until the Son of Man is raised from the dead. Then we're authorized to say, well, by golly, we saw him with Moses and Elijah, and everybody was wearing, ta-da, resurrection clothes. Because Moses and Elijah are the two folks, according to the tradition anyway, that are already with God. Elijah, having not died according to the Deuteronomistic history, but was taken up in the sweet low swinging chariot. And Moses, well, Deuteronomy 34 says he died, but the book called The Assumption of Moses says he was taken to heaven and saved from Satan, from death in that way. And we do know that the early Christians put stock in the book called The Assumption of Moses because the book of Jude quotes it, provingly. And for that reason, the book of Jude almost didn't make the canon, because it seems, you know, it quotes this odd apocryphal book that people weren't too sure about. And 2 Peter almost didn't make the canon because it quotes Jude, which quotes The Assumption of Moses. But in any case, Moses and Elijah are folks already with God, and we have seen Jesus in that company. That's what we say post-resurrection. That's the story we're supposed to tell. We saw him with the great teacher of Israel and the protector of Israel among the folks that represent the law and the prophets. And that's what we say post-resurrection. I think there's another thing that we're supposed to do in addition to telling the story of the transfiguration, and that is, you know, the most winsome statement of how this works that I've ever seen is at the end of Gordon Lathrop's book called Holy Things. He suggests that when you get to the end of Mark and you realize you've just been told Jesus has gone to Galilee and there you will see him even as he told you, what you're supposed to do is go back through the story, which of course starts in Galilee, and see, what did he tell us? If you go back to the beginning of Mark and you start over, you reread it with this new question in mind, where is the risen Jesus and what is he doing? And we're going to Galilee to find out. And when we go back to Galilee by way of the beginning of Mark's story and start over, we find he's all over the place. Marcus Borg has taught very convincingly that John's gospel presents us with the post-Easter Jesus, and that Mark gives us the pre-Easter Jesus. Along with Gordon Lathrop, I believe Mark gives us both. The pre-Easter Jesus, who does all this huffing and puffing and bellowing like a war horse and saying all sorts of other crazy stuff, and the post-Easter Jesus. The post-Easter Jesus, who, for example, shows up in these rather curious ways, for example, in the story of the sea crossing that has him sleeping in the stern of the boat on the cushion. Now, there's a weird story for you. Do you know what's supposed to happen in the stern of the boat on the cushion back there?
Just did.
Yeah, the tiller is back there. If the person at the tiller is sleeping through a storm, there's trouble. It's no wonder they start yelling, "What's the matter with you? Don't you care if we live or die?" Which is an echo in the way that it happens in Mark's story of Isaiah 51, when the prophet has to scream at God in the days of the Exodus. "Awake, awake, put on strength, O arm of the Lord. Don't you know what's happening here? There's a water problem." This is not just that first time through. The second time through, this is the little church, the early church, the little community in their boat. Translated into Latin, nave. We still call our churches boats. It's a favorite image, or a favorite image of the early church. So it's the little Christian community in the boat, tossed on the stormy sea of life, and the Lord is asleep at the wheel. But we're dying here in Rome. we're gonna go down. We're gonna be wiped out. Awake. Awake, Lord. And what Jesus does is he gets up and he screams at the wind and the sea. There's another water crossing story in which the disciples are going across to the other side. Jesus says he's going to pray a little bit. And then he goes out and walks next to them. They're right there with him. And they don't know who it is. They think they're seeing a ghost. And they get terrified. It's just like the Emmaus story, except it's on the water. Again, it's the little community in the boat, and the risen Christ is right there with them, and they don't know it. They have to learn that it's him out there on the water with them. Well, I think these feeding stories are also the risen Christ setting the messianic banquet for Jews and for Gentiles. And then we get to this last water crossing story that we were at here this morning, where the argument, it's not an argument, where there's all this confusion about the food. And in this second time through, this isn't just a story about the fact that we're so stupid we don't get the fact that Jesus can do miracles and give us lunch. Nor is it about what are we going to feed these people, the Herodians and the Pharisees, they got stuff to feed, what are we going to feed? This is a story about inside the boat, all we need is one loaf. We don't need two kinds of food anymore. We don't need food in two kinds of baskets. We don't need two separate communities. One of 5,000, one of 4,000, we got one loaf. We feed with one bread. It's enough. That's all we need. So it's one bread for Jews and one bread for Gentiles. That's all we need in this boat. So I think there's a kind of a post-Easter allegorical reading here that's about, again, the inclusion of Gentiles into the community and the uniting of everyone at this one table around one loaf. That's it. That's what I think. But this is another way that Mark is preaching to the situation of disunity and the struggle over Jews and Gentiles. So it's all finally one banquet. And we have this banquet together in the boat. The healing of the blind man, to follow this story, the last piece of the sequence is a story that we've bumped up against several times this week. The story that Carol preached on. At the beginning of the week, you can have all this experience up to this point in Mark, and still, you can see, but it's still not clear. It's going to take something else before we finally get everything really clear. And if you've got a Bible, that's if your Bible is there at the end of Mark 8, we talked about how all these stories. I talked about how all these stories are kind of the midpoint of Mark. Two-stage healing of the blind man, who's going to need a second jolt of power. I suggested that it's going to be the crucifixion. Then we get the confession of Peter at Caesarea Philippi, and then we get the transfiguration. And at the end of the transfiguration, there's one little meal thing that I didn't call a meal story, and this is where we'll begin tomorrow. He said to them, "Truly, I tell you, there are some standing here who will not taste death until they see that the kingdom of God has come with power. It doesn't say they won't taste death. It doesn't say they won't have that banquet. But they won't have that banquet before they see the kingdom of God come with power. And that's what we're going to see tomorrow. That banquet, that last, more than one last supper. But it's the tasting of death that will occupy us tomorrow, the last feast. But we have time for questions today. Today's one of those days like my classes at the university. It's all a little bit too complicated. People scratching their heads thinking, what is the matter with them? Yes?
Fred, I'm interested in the connection between these stories about food and then the healing in terms of the significance of the body. I mean, in the one, in the food story, in the feeding stories, you're dealing with with a physical and a spiritual hunger. And so he's tending to the body, the bodily needs in that way, and then in the healing stories, he's responding to the body that's not functioning. That's not functioning properly. I guess my question is, can you say any more about? I mean, I sort of see an interesting connection there, but from your study, how do you see those two things, that bodily care that Jesus is giving in both of those scenarios fitting together?
Well, I think what I've meant to suggest in multiple ways here is that I, for one, anyway, see a metaphorical level to every single one of these kinds of stories. Mm-hmm. There's a sense in which we read a story of Jesus doing certain simple healings that are the at least momentary repair of someone's body. Mm-hmm. But if you think about how these kinds of things are thought of in the whole biblical tradition, to heal a lame man so that he can walk, and this isn't just Mark, this is elsewhere, is it in Luke that you get this bent over woman whom Jesus straightens up so that she can walk ortho? And she praises Jesus so that she also does orthodoxy, which is what Greek would be for what she did. When you allow someone to walk in the context of Judaism, you aren't just allowing them to put one foot in front of the other. Walking in ancient Judaism was the metaphor for being able to live a meaningful life. Mm-hmm. And even Christianity picked that up by calling what they did the way. Mm-hmm. And anybody who's allowed to walk, the word for living a meaningful life and being taught to live a meaningful life in Judaism was to be given halakha. That's what Jewish teachers gave people. Halakha, a way. A path, a way on which to live in, and it's the word for walking. It's I'm giving you a way to walk. So to make the lame walk also has another level of being able to live a meaningful life. To heal blind people is to allow them to see not just the trees and the flowers, but the truth of their existence. to make the deaf hear is for sure to be able to hear the birds and grandchildren, but to hear the promise, to hear the word of God, and so forth and so forth. And the food, you know, like from Deuteronomy on, the lesson is we don't live by bread alone, but we live by the promises of God that you are mine. So it's always, you know, every one of these things has a kind of immediate sense to it. But when we keep preaching these stories, it's because of this other level that there is to all these things. They're really about so much more of our lives. It's not that our bodies aren't important. They certainly are, and I don't mean to be saying, you know, I'm not a Gnostic.
There's a question there.
But yeah.
Well, I've been a little bit bothered since early on this morning, talking about, I guess I, you know, kind of believed in Jesus being fully God and fully divine and fully human, and of course the Syrophoenician woman situation really underscores his full humanity. But then you alluded to the fact there are still some people out there that believe in the divinity of Jesus, and most of us that are more educated probably don't anymore. And I probably misread that totally, but that kind of is a thorn in my flesh today.
You thought I said you were a certain kind of person? Is that
no, not me, but I'm just saying, you know, that, okay, Jesus' humanity was underscored in the story of the, and what he said about giving food to the dogs and so on, and that certainly underscores his humanity in a way that some of us maybe haven't thought about before. And what you say about the divinity of Jesus, is that something that you said there are some people that still believe in the divinity of Jesus, and that's kind of going by the wayside, are you saying?
It certainly is in the scholarly guild.
I know.
Yeah, that's mostly who I meant. You know, the people out there that I call the Biblepreneurs. People who publish a couple books every Easter with sensational stories about the Gospel of Judas or this or that or the other thing. You know, so that Christians will quickly buy all this stuff up, if nothing else, in order to condemn it. You know, among the evangelicals, none of those people, not none of them, most of those people, and I know them, I'm in the guild, they think that this is all just kind of a historical curiosity. You know, and I don't really need to get into that whole conversation. In one of the conversations I had with folks last night about all this, I think I might have said it better than I said yesterday. I think that what we witness, for example, in the story of the Syrophoenician woman, is a narrative way of stating what Paul says in 2 Corinthians 5, when he says that God was in Christ reconciling the world to God's self. Now, reconciliation can only happen where justice and mercy are finally both managed. You know, the world being the way it is, broken and fouled the way it is, there is so much forgiveness that's necessary. And forgiveness can only come finally from mercy, but we can't live without justice either. And in a story like the story of the Syrophoenician woman, there certainly is the need for mercy. But it was God who said there's a special people. It wasn't, depending upon how you look at this, if you look at this strictly from a purely humanist point of view, of course we would say, well, that's just the Jews' story. The Jews decided they were the chosen people and they blame it on God. Or they attribute it to God, Sometimes they blamed it on God. But the book, and it's the book of the Christian church too, says God chose them. They are the chosen people. And it's also in the book that you had better stay away from those other people. You know, read Ezra and Nehemiah. That's in the canon too. All the stuff about clean and unclean and who we stay away from and how, especially, you know, anything that might lead to a coupling of Jew and Gentile. So that's God's directive. And in this moment out there near Tyre and Sidon, it's God's mercy. I mean, I think Susan's right. It's the Holy Spirit out there screaming, help me, or help my child. And it's God who said, you are a holy people, separate. And so it's God's stuff smacking together in this moment, in this person. And, you know, when God's mercy and God's justice collide, it's cataclysmic. It kills you, which is what I think happens on the cross, which is why, you know, I agree with Susan. That was a crucifixion out there that day. But I hesitate to say that Mark is thinking, you know, of Chalcedon. Not hesitate, I deny. Mark is thinking already of the full-blown Chalcedonian questions, but Mark and his story is already giving us pictures of the things that happened in the Christ event that it took the church centuries to finally sort out so that they could explain so that it stays good news. I don't know if I've even come close to addressing what you meant to ask about. It's six after.
Fred, what I hear you asking and being troubled about is whether today our teacher, in stressing the deep and old humanity of Jesus, he's saying that those of us who are really educated no longer see that paradoxically also the full divinity is present in Jesus. Is that your concern?
That's right.
Yeah. So your question to Fred is he dismissing the church's confession of the divinity of Jesus?
That's right.
No, and I don't mean to be at all. No, I'm as orthodox as the day is long.
So you don't have to be afraid. Don't take that thorn out of your flesh.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I guess all I really did mean to be saying, and I probably said it in a way that indicated too much, is there are plenty of people who think of themselves as Christians in this world who only think of Jesus as a rather extraordinary human being. To my way of thinking, the theological tradition to which Holden is most connected, the Lutheran tradition, that just doesn't work in that tradition. You know, the Lutheran confessional theology requires the Chalcedonian solution, finally, that you answer the question, is he God or is he man? Yes.
And most of us just struggle with that paradox. Mm-hmm. Struggle to understand it.
Absolutely. And it's not understandable. Mm-hmm. That's the problem. It's an ununderstandable paradox that requires that you beat your head against it for your whole life. But I persist in beating my head against it. It's 10 after. I don't know. We should. We'll just.